Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Christian healing at Bristol Healing Rooms, the Baptist Church on City Road in Stokes Croft. Also, Mary Pike has been over to Greece this summer working with Refuge for Refugees. An investigative journalist and blogger, Michael Tyler, one of the best, but I bet you've never heard of him. He's been looking into the deaths of the 80 dead bankers over the last couple of years. Can you guess the top three countries they're from and the top three banks? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street, and I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. I'm joined by Dave Coates and Jane Hoskins. Dave, you're from a healing group here in the city, just down the road from us here in Stokes Croft, down towards the Bear Pit on the left-hand side, the Baptist Church. What's the group called?
Yeah, it's called the Bristol Healing Rooms. We're part of the National Healing Rooms of England and Wales, but we're the sort of Bristol branch of that.
Now, there are other sorts of healing institutions in the city. Some of them will provide you with things like warm baths and things like that. What makes yours different?
We pray in the name of Jesus. We believe that Jesus healed everybody that came to him, and then he told his disciples to go and do the same thing. And, there's probably different ways of praying for healing, but we particularly pray for people to be healed in Jesus' name. That's the distinctive thing.
Well, so what's your story? How have you come to this as part of your faith?
I've always been interested in healing, and my family have been healed of various things over the years.
Okay, what, for example?
Twisted spines and low blood hemoglobin, things like that.
I mean, these can be put down to other things. I mean, changes of diets, use of osteopaths, doctors. What makes you think that this is some sort of spiritual healing going on?
Yeah, I mean, my father was healed of scoliosis, where it's a twisted spine, which is quite difficult to treat without quite invasive surgery and so on, I believe. But we've, I saw his spine straighten up under healing,
Is this something that happens instantly, or is it over weeks, months?
It just happened instantly, yeah. And I've seen many healings as a child, so I got interested in healing.
Well, okay, as a child, what did you see then? Yeah. We're going back even further.
Yeah. I used to go to meetings where people would pray for the sick as a regular occurrence. For example, there was a time when in North Wales I went to visit a church where there was a man called Peter Scothen praying for people. He preached a very simple message, and then he asked people to come forward for prayer, firstly to receive Christ as their personal saviour, which he also thought was a key thing, but also then to receive healing. And the whole room was full of people with wheelchairs and crutches and so on, and they'd all come specifically for prayer. And by the end of the day, all the crutches and wheelchairs were on the stage and people were running around the room.
Now, I don't know if you've seen it since we last spoke, but there's a famous film of the great Randy exposing con men who were deliberately mishealing people. In other words, that what they were doing was pretending to heal people, but they had people prepared in the audience, this kind of thing, to make it look exciting. Now, this sort of fakery can go on. So what makes you think that that hasn't happened in the experiences you've seen?
I think that's all about the cases that I've heard about is about people who have been talking about information. Somebody was sharing information and their knowledge about somebody. What I saw was totally different, because people were literally wheeled up in wheelchairs, coming on crutches, and were being healed, and they were literally running around the room, So I don't believe there's any con going on at all.
Well, that's
what we've actually seen that in the Bear Pit ourselves. We've seen people healed, who've come up and had prayer.
Okay, well, before I press you more on that, because I mean, it's quite proven that there are people out there who take some sort of entertainment in conning people, scientists as well, into believing that this is going on when it isn't. So what's been going on in the bear pit? This is news to me.
So, well, we operate at City Road Baptist Church, so on a Wednesday afternoon between 12 and 3:30, and have done since the spring. But we also go out in the streets, and we also offer to pray for people outside church. And, we just share stories about people who've been healed, and we ask people to come forward. And there was one example where a lady came forward who'd for 25 years had a kyphosis, which is like a hunchback, and the spine is permanently twisted, and she was shuffling up on two sticks and in a lot of pain. And she said, could we pray for her? And we prayed for her, and her back straightened right in front of our eyes. And there was an orthopedic surgeon present who just retired, and he said, I spent the whole of my life working on spines, and I've never seen anything like it happen before. He said, Jesus healed that back in about 3 seconds. It just straightened up,
So do you think there should be some department at the BRI where people go through there getting the, 20 people or so healing them, and that might actually be a department of the NHS?
We would love to be part of the healthcare system in Bristol,
Do you ever get people referred to you? I mean, even by a doctor or by anybody?
We've had people referred to us by doctors. And some of the things that we see are sort of incurable. We've had people who have had food allergies that aren't really curable as such, prayed for, and they've seen very, very substantial improvements. Like we had a chap with 3 or 4 food allergies, and at least 2 of them were completely healed, and the others were so dramatically improved that he could eat things in that category, whereas before he would be hospitalised now.
I suppose it's quite a lot of GPs that if they're scratching their head about something, I mean, the idea of referring them to you wouldn't even come into their mind.
No, there is a healing room down on the south coast in Dorset where they actually operate inside a GP surgery, and they're well known to us. And
so where's
the GPs? That's in Portland, and and Weymouth. They have like two separate healing rooms as part of the same group, and GPs actually refer them.
So you're working towards that here in Bristol.
We would love to be more, involved with the healthcare.
But look, I'm not going to let you get away with the great Randy, right? Because if anyone wants to look it up online, you'll see a so-called spiritual healer called Peter Popoff. And maybe his name was made up and some sort of Mickey take anyway. But the great Randy just completely exposes him as a complete fraud with microphones in his ear and someone nearby relaying him information from a central database so that he was able to really make it look as if there was this healing going on. It was an illusion.
I don't know anything about him.
Well, watch it. What I say is next time you've got to watch it because this is your competition in a way.
Yeah.
People who are down to discredit people like you.
Well, there was another lady in the bear pit called Emily who came, and she also had a kyphosis of the spine for 10 years. And we prayed for her, and she felt like, she said, there's a hand on my back, and it's straightening my spine. And she said, how long is that hand going to be there? And I sort of no idea, but she says, I think like God has got his hand on my back, and he's straightening it. And we'd never seen anything like that, but afterwards her back was straighter. And she came to City Road Baptist Church the following morning and said, I want to tell you guys that I'm still healed. I suppose the proof is of the pudding is in the eating.
It certainly is. Well, talking of which, that sounds like a bit of a not necessarily the nicest way to introduce you, Jane, but you're here with us and you believe that you've been healed by Bristol Healing Rooms, don't you?
I've certainly recently been healed. I met and joined the Bristol Healing Room teams shortly afterwards.
Oh, right. So you've now actually become part of, because you've been healed yourself. You've decided to join it.
Yeah.
And you're actually doing the healing as well.
Yeah.
So what was the start for you? I mean, what sort of medical situation were you in?
So I had very severe ME with sort of really kind of high level of care needs. I was actually living in a disability place in Lochlease, Gainsborough Court, and the illness made me very, very weak. So I was actually bedbound for 3 years and was able to do very little for myself. And I had no mobility really. And I was so weak I had to be spoon fed. So it was a seriously challenging situation.
So how did that come on? I mean, you know, when did that start? If I can ask, how old were you?
Old enough.
Well, because ME is something you think of maybe as being for younger people rather than older people, isn't it?
I was originally 15 when I had the first bout of it. Yeah, wow. Yeah.
And how old when you were bedridden?
Well, I've had kind of bouts of it at different times, really. Yeah. If I could just explain what happened, I was praying for healing. And I kept praying for healing during that really difficult situation. And
for how long? I mean, how long were you in there?
I was bedbound for 3 years.
Yeah.
Just a few months ago, I had a sense that things were about to change. Hard to explain that exactly, but I kept on praying, and it got to a point where I felt, as I was praying, I felt that God was saying to me that He wanted me to try and do the things that I couldn't do. And as if I was willing to believe Him, He would give me the strength. And so that day I was able to walk around the flat, and then just a few days later I actually walked out of the building, and then 2 months later, which was really quite recently, I've been able to walk 3 miles. So
okay, but this was through you just praying yourself?
Yeah.
I mean, but the thing is, sometimes, you know, something like ME, people have their ups and downs, don't they? It may be that you just had a sort of 3 year bout of it and that's over, hopefully. And it's nothing to do with the praying.
Yeah, I've really genuinely never heard of anybody with severe ME at that level who was able to walk 3 miles a couple of months later. I mean, even purely from a fitness point of view, it doesn't really make any sense.
I don't want to press you too much, but I think age is important. If people are listening, were you in 30s, 40s, roughly what?
Over 40.
Yeah, okay. Mm. So you then have now got involved, but were you actually prayed for yourself by the healing group?
I was prayed for by lots of friends at different times. So there were a lot of people who were actually praying for me.
Do you think it makes a difference if it's like someone is praying far away for you or comes to you to pray, or if you've got a whole load of people all around you? Does it make any difference?
I don't think distance makes a difference, because there's a situation in the Bible where somebody comes to Jesus asking for prayer for his servant, and the servant is healed, who's some distance away from the conversation that they're having. So,
but have you found this reflected in your experience or not? I mean, it's all very well reading about it in the Bible, but with your healing experience, have you found that sort of thing happening from afar or what?
I think it can really help if somebody is with you, because I think it can increase your faith. So that's why with the Healing Rooms team, we're encouraging people to come down to the church in City Road or to the Bear Pit to get prayer, because it can be a powerful thing if somebody lays hands on you and prays with you, definitely.
Okay, well, back to you, Dave. What was your experience with Jane? When did you first meet her?
A friend introduced her to, and one of the friends who comes to the Healing Room, one of the team members met her, and she said, "Oh, you must meet Jane. She's had some prayer. She's been healed, and you know, she'd like to tell us about it." So,
and now, how many people are part of the team?
It's probably about 20 people, something like that.
So, do you ever get in a situation where you've got one person in the middle there and 20 people all around them? I mean, I can imagine that could be a bit intimidating.
Yeah, not everybody. So we do some meetings, some prayer times, Wednesday afternoon, some Wednesday morning, some on Friday evening. So different people come at different times. So we have a team We have a wider group, actually, but probably about that number of people come regularly at different sort of times when they're available.
And Jane, what message have you got for listeners who are thinking, well, I've tried everything with the doctor, is there anything else?
Well, ME is a condition that, sadly, at this time, doctors are not really able to treat. So there are a lot of people, even sort of young and relatively young people, who can be bedbound for a long time and there's no medical answers. So I would say if you have a chronic condition and there are no medical answers, that prayer and God may be your answer.
The other thing, of course, is some of the solutions offered by doctors, Dave, they're pretty drastic, aren't they?
Yeah, I've got no gripes with the medical sector, and they do a great job for all of us, you know. But there are things where there's no treatment really feasible, or maybe it's just like some maintenance on drugs or something. And that's exciting area where we pray for people for incurable conditions, and then we see them healed. That's obviously
I'm a bit concerned because it sounds like you're saying that we're a last port of call, incurables only, you know.
No, rather than,
you know, it seems to me that it'd be quite nice to help people before they get really sick, you know, or at the point at which they're first getting ill.
Yeah, no, I agree. Some people do actually say, rather than going to my doctor, I'd like to come to the healing rooms and get prayer.
So do you get people who've come to you, got nowhere, and then have to go to the doctor afterwards?
We haven't particularly heard of that.
No, they probably don't tell you. No, they just run off to the doctor. And we're also joined by Adrian Galvin. Adrian, you're part of this group as well. How long have you been involved?
January is when I joined up. I heard they were in town and I thought, oh, it'd be a good outlet to practice my faith, and I joined them. And
now you're sounding a bit Irish to me. You've been in Bristol a long time?
9 years now.
And what way did you need to get involved? Was it because of through your faith or through needing sort of healing?
Yeah, because of the experiences that I had, I developed a passion to see other people experience the same breakthroughs that I had.
So what happened to you originally?
My story goes back thereabouts 18 years. I was an alcoholic, not quite a drug addict, but a regular drug user, smoked a lot of cannabis and stuff. I started getting very paranoid, very insecure, there were the early stages of psychosis.
Can I ask you why? Why the drugs? Why the cannabis in the first place?
It's like part... one thing is because that was the life that was at home. I mean, drinking was very much part of our culture at home. The drugs came along later. I didn't start till I was about 28 on drugs, smoking cannabis and ecstasy and things. I was living in London at the time. And over the course of about 2 years, I started to notice I was withdrawing from people. I was starting to feel paranoid. And I was putting it down to the cannabis, but I didn't realize it was actually a mental condition starting to develop as well. I went backpacking, ended up in India, started getting involved in spiritual activities over there, trying to find myself as I was backpacking. And
How was that in India? What happened in India? You just sort of wander into a temple or something?
Yeah, there's plenty of opportunities. It's full of spiritual opportunities in India. I started trying transcendental meditation, seeing if I could find some kind of peace in the spiritual activities there and stuff. But for me personally, it worked straight away. I went into some kind of spiritual experience. But for me personally, it was like opening a Pandora's box. I was starting to see through, and it was part of my gifting now in the spirit. I was starting to see through a lot of what was going on. I could see a lot of demonic activity, kind of a scary topic for a lot of people. But in a very short period of time, I realized that I couldn't switch off the experiences that I was having.
When you say seeing demonic activity, what exactly do you mean there?
I could see that the experiences that I was having spiritually, there was like entities involved. There was like personalities involved.
So you're hallucinating or what?
I look back on it now when I say to people, because of the mental illness, I'm not sure how much was hallucination and how much was actually spiritual experience. But I do know, if you could hear my whole story, when I started getting deliverance from demonic activity, that's when I started getting my sanity back.
And so when did that start and how?
Over a period of 2 years, I was backpacking. I ended up in New Zealand. And I was working on an orchard there, trying to keep myself in one piece. I was too afraid to come home. My mind was gone so far. I ended up rambling into, after a series of experiences, a Christian bookshop, not really knowing why I was in there. And I was looking around at the shelves at all the books. And one particular book was like it leapt out at me. And it was called Demons Defeated by a guy called Bill Sobritsky. I read the book in the shop in just through the afternoon, just devoured the book. answered so many questions I had, really kind of enlightened me.
Give us one or two of the questions that it was answering for you.
It was confirming that what I was experiencing was demonic activity. At the time, it said that one of the doors that you can open onto demonic activity was taking drugs. Afterwards, I found out my dad had left when I was 2 years of age. After I became a Christian, after reading this book, it said, you know, ask Jesus into your life and he can help you to kick the stuff out. One of the impressions that I started getting strongly on my heart was to go back to Ireland and find my father, who had been gone out of my life since I was 2 years of age. I went along, knocked on the door, introduced myself. I'd only seen him 3 times in my life. And I told him, listen, I said, I felt like I needed to find you. I'd just come back from traveling. I said, my mind is been going over the last couple of years. He stepped back in shock and he said to me, when you were like 2 years of age, he said, when you were youngsters, he said, that stuff started happening to me. And he said, I left, he said, I didn't want it rubbing off on you. And I left, he said, I came over to the UK, went over to the UK. He said, within 2 weeks, I was in a psychiatric hospital. He said, when I came out, I couldn't remember being married. I couldn't remember having children. He was so badly medicated. I knew the book had said that one of the entry points is generational, that there can be mental illness in families. So that was one of the keys that I presented or was presented to me in the whole healing journey, that to address the generational issues, whatever spirits were there, command them to leave and close the doors to the drugs, do repentance. And healing came to me. It was amazing. I mean, I have so much peace of mind now.
That sounds great. But I mean, healing has come to you. Yeah. But how, through this group, are you able to help heal others?
Yeah. Well, through this group, one of the big things I'm able to do when we meet people suffering mental illness is to be able to relate to people. One of the big keys to my healing was the hope that I got when I read that book and read the testimonies of the possibility of recovery. So I always, before we get into the healing, I always like to sit down with people and share a little bit of my story. And the power of hope, when it goes in, it just awakens people to the possibility. Hopelessness is a terrible situation and people really get very unwell and very ill. And
despair and suicide actually rife. I mean, Bristol University's got one of the highest suicide rates. I mean, it's probably got something to do with all the student debt and that sort of thing. But, you know, it seems to be almost programmed into the modern world that, particularly for young people, it's really difficult to get work, that kind of thing. And a lot of people don't see it as taking away hope, but that's what it's doing.
Yeah. It's like, what's the point of it all? People think, oh, it's easier to be dead. And they choose going that direction.
Yeah, funny enough, I mean, I was out in the developing world beginning of this year, and everybody seems to have the space, even out there, to do stuff, you know, whether it's to make something. Over here, it seems to be difficult to even find somewhere to live.
Yeah.
That's the crazy difference. Anyway, so when you're actually doing these healing sessions, if someone comes along to the Bristol Healing Rooms, what can they expect?
Hospitality is the first thing, a warm cup of tea, and we make people feel welcome. And then we sit with them and share who we are. I like to share a bit of my story just to encourage people and store up a kind of the atmosphere of faith. And then we just ask a person, like, what is it that they specifically need prayer for? And we just allow the person time to share. If we get any inspiration or feel any kind of leading in the Holy Spirit to share something that might help them receive. It's all, we believe that Jesus really wants to heal people. Oftentimes the problem is on the end of the person receiving the healing. And sometimes people can believe like funny things like, oh, God won't want to heal me because I did such and such when I was like 12 years of age. And they carry around this burden of guilt or shame or whatever.
That's quite common in Ireland with the Catholic Church, isn't
it? Very much so, yeah.
I mean, how did you get on was the Catholic Church part of your upbringing? Or
yeah,
not?
Very much so. Well, I wouldn't say very much so. As soon as I had permission to not go to Mass, I took it and I didn't go. So
do you think that the established church in Britain and Ireland is doing enough on this healing business? I mean, was there anything going on much over in Ireland?
Not in the traditional church. I know all my neighbours are all Catholic and they see the transformation in me since every time I go home. People are always just like, they can see the difference. They remember what it was like. I was a very heavy drinker. I had deliverance from as much as healing from mental illness issues. I had deliverance from alcoholism. So I arrive back and they don't see me from one end of the year to the next. And when they see me, it's just like, wow, he's still off to drink. And it's a miracle as far as people are at home, because we don't hear of people like going off to drink like that unless you're dying. You know?
So once you're on it, that's it.
Once you're on normally, it, that's it. You know, if he loves the drink, he loves the drinking.
Dave, just remind us where and when the Bristol Healing Rooms is in effect.
It's 12 till 3:30 on a Wednesday afternoon. And sometimes also at another church in East Bristol called Resound. First one at Resound is at 7 o'clock in the evening on Friday.
Where is Resound?
It's on the Bristol Healing Rooms website. If you go www.bristolhealingrooms.com.
Okay, so the on a Wednesday it's 2 to 4 City Road at the City Road Baptist Church. If you like postcodes, that's BS28UL. And on a Friday evening, the 1st and the 3rd in the month, that's Black Horse Road, the Resound Church, Mangotsfield, BS16 9BP. So, Adrian Galvin, Jane Hoskins and Dave Coates, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, I'm joined now by Mary Pike. Mary's not, well, you're not really working for Refuge for Refugees, but you've been volunteering with them, haven't you, recently? Why did you decide to do that?
I wanted to go out to Athens to kind of get us, see what things were like on the ground, because since the kind of major crisis in 2015, the refugee crisis hasn't really been in the media, but I didn't believe that it was all fine now. So I was travelling around Europe, so I wanted to go to Athens and kind of get a feel of what was going on there now.
So tell us about this Refuge for Refugees group.
So Refuge for Refugees work mainly with people living on the street, so providing food, clothing for people on the street.
So is that in the UK or other parts of Europe, everywhere?
No, this is in Athens, well, across Greece, but predominantly in Athens. So, yeah, they provide food and clothing for people on the streets. They also help with housing for mainly for families. If they've got young children, then they'll try and find them housing.
So first of all, what's it like in Athens? Because I know that there's been horrific austerity over in Greece. A lot of the Greeks saying, well, the Germans have taken all our money. And there's obviously some truth to that. But there's also this far left part, well, not probably not far left, left wing party anyway, Syriza, which has promised to try and do everything it can for Greek people to increase what the government's doing. So what's the effect of that been on the ground? They had a vote a couple of years ago, didn't they, to say we actually don't want to bail out, so we want to get rid of the euro, and that never really happened.
It's interesting on the ground, because going there kind of as a tourist, you wouldn't really notice that anything was going on at all. It's all very behind the scenes now. So a lot of the kind of obvious problems that you would think of, like food, housing, that kind of thing, have been dealt with, not necessarily well, but they have been. But there's a sort of backlog problem of people. You've got all these children that haven't been to school, like refugee children that haven't been to school for years. They're not living in decent housing. And then there's also refugees being sent back to Greece after they've been sent to other European countries for whatever reason. They're sent
back to Greece. It's almost like a dumping ground.
It's a dumping ground, and it's a, well, I described it as a holding cell. So you've got people are arriving in, well, to the islands, and then they eventually get to Athens. They're registered there, but that's not where they want to stay. So they will say which European country they want to go to, but there's people waiting months or years to get an answer as to whether they can go to that country. So they can't actually settle in Athens as refugees and build a life for themselves there, because they're waiting for an answer to where they can go next. So
how long were you there for, and when were you there?
I was there for 5 weeks this summer.
What did you see? And what sort of work were you doing?
So I'd say mostly what I was doing was working with people living on the streets, which is, there are local Greek people and refugees on the streets. And a lot of them, we had a team of doctors that came out as well, because a lot of them can't get medical care. Especially the refugees will be passed from this hospital to that hospital to this hospital, and they just kind of give up in the end. Because they can't, and it's just minor injuries, but they'll turn into kind of major injuries because they're not getting the help that they need. And then we also did children's activities as well, because you've got all these children that don't have anything to do all day, so just go in and playing games with them in the evening so that they've got some kind of
I mean, can't the parents do that?
They can, I suppose, but they're not, they don't have the resources there. They don't have any money. The children aren't going to school. They might not speak the language. It's really difficult for them. They they don't have their support network as well, because they're one family's in this flat over there, the other family's in this flat over there, so they've been very separated. And they've come from a war zone as well, which people don't take into account, I think, what effect that can have on your mental health.
So whereabouts, I mean, in Africa or in the Middle East, which countries were most of the people from that you came across?
So in Athens, it's mainly from the Middle East, because they're coming through from Turkey. I think from Africa, people tend to go to Italy. So that there were Africans there, but it was predominantly the Middle East. And there seemed to be a hierarchy sort of even within that. So because of the current conflict, people from Syria seem to be sort of top of the list for getting the help that was available. But for some reason, I don't know why, people from Pakistan, Afghanistan seem to be at the bottom of the list. So those were mainly the people that were living on the streets and that couldn't get access to the medical care that they needed.
In Pakistan, for example, surely people can stay there. I mean, it's not really a war going on in Pakistan.
No, but then they're coming because of poverty. There's all sorts of reasons. You've got people coming from war zone, which is why people from Syria are sort of top of the list. And then you've got people, economic migrants, people coming, yeah, because they're living in poverty, because of climate change, all sorts of reasons that they're coming in.
So what do you think is the main reason for this migrant crisis?
I don't know what the main reason for it is. That's difficult.
it's almost impossible. Yeah. It seems like, you know, so many people moving across the world just within the last few years, almost as many as the, you know, say something like the Scottish and the Irish being shipped out to North America. You know, it's a massive movement of people.
Yeah.
Do you think the Greek government is, and the Greek people are really able to cope with the situation as it is now?
I don't think so, no, because they've got their own problems with the economic crash in Greece. They've got their own problems, and the kind of interaction I had with sort of local Greek people as well is completely separate to the voluntary work I was doing. They've got their own lives and their own problems to think about. So it's just not a priority, and a lot of the voluntary organisations that are doing work are non-Greek, which isn't to say, you know, that the Greek people don't care, but they just have their own problems to deal with.
They don't have the resources, do they, really, necessarily to do that?
Either.
That is in terms of money.
Yeah.
They probably got the resources in terms of unemployed people, but...
And a lot of the funding, so... I was working for another organisation called Hope Cafe, which was just a sort of community space for refugees. They had a kitchen. And in 2015, they were getting so much funding coming from England because it was in the media. And now it's kind of died down. They're not getting half as much funding, and they're really struggling now.
So how to sort it out? I mean, there must have been some of these refugees, some of the Greek people must have had thoughts about how are we going to sort this?
Well, a lot of it is... getting things moving faster, because, as I say, a lot of the people there in this holding cell, because they're waiting,
cutting through the bureaucracy a bit.
Yeah, because they're waiting for an answer from the other countries. And even I met one guy who was he'd been told that he could go to Portugal, but he'd been waiting 18 months just for a date of when, so he had the permission to go, but he didn't know when. So he's just in this holding cell in Athens. He can't really start a life for himself there because he knows he's going to Portugal, but he doesn't know when. And he was only 15 years old as well.
I mean, the cynical will say that actually some of the rich and powerful in Europe are quite happy for all these people to be coming in because it's cheap labour.
Yeah, but they don't seem to be, they still don't seem to be bringing them out of Athens very quickly, if that's the case.
Okay, Mary, what advice have you got for anyone thinking about contributing, you know, from here in Bristol to help refugees?
I would say go out there if you can. Obviously, not everyone has the opportunity to do that, but go out there and offer your hands to help with the situation and actually see what's going on there.
Any end in sight to this problem with the so many people moving across the Mediterranean, up through Turkey? Any end in sight?
I don't think so at the moment, no.
Well, sad to leave it at that. I mean, we've got to have some light at the end of the tunnel, surely.
Well, I think it's a historical thing, people moving. I don't think it's ever going to end. It just needs to be dealt with in a better way.
Well, let's hope it is. Anyway, Mary Pike, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, I'm joined on the line now by Michael Tyler. Michael runs his blog, his own personal blog. It's at michaeltyler.co.uk. But Michael's done something that our useless mainstream press in London just have not been bothered to do, which is to, amongst many other things, compile a list of some of the dead bankers, that is to say, serious money types from the City of London and elsewhere, Wall Street, many other places around the world where there's big financial centres. And many of them have been suicides. But as Michael has documented, actually, it looks like quite a lot of them might have been murdered. And there's not really been any kind of proper investigation into this. Anyway, Michael, welcome to Dialect. Let's just start by, how many bankers have you got on your list now?
Well, in all, I think there's about 80 dead bankers listed down there on the, when I last looked.
I mean, are there any patterns if you're going through the list? I mean, a lot of these people, of course, are not known. They really wouldn't be known to anyone. I mean, bankers tend to turn up at the job. They're fairly anonymous. They take great pay amounts of pay home. But in the wider society, certainly in the public domain, and they don't have any kind of celebrity status or any kind of knowledge. The public doesn't know who they are.
No, well, they're just there to make money, aren't they? I mean, the idea of the investment banking arm is just, it's to use the retail banking arm as a kind of a proxy for its money making. Really, the retail. So when we talk about bankers, we're not talking about the people sitting behind the branch in Barclays on the high street. We're talking people that usually sit behind a terminal looking at Bloomberg Terminal. Or, they're getting, they're basically at the top end information-wise in the company, or certainly moving towards there. So they're holding the company philosophy, and that philosophy is one where we're gonna use you, and we're gonna rape you and take what we can, in the most, ruthless fashion. If you're talking about the really, like the JP Morgans, who said, there's a good reason to do something, and then there's the real reason to do something, and that's, that's the idea, is to to be as ruthless and as lizard-like as they possibly can.
Hey, that's a provocative term to use. But look, what you've done by pulling all these, nearly 80 dead bankers, mostly suicides, together and documenting it, what made you decide to start that list?
When society teaches you from a very young age that you're going to be someone that has a responsibility, you're taught that even from a young age, where you don't really have a responsibility, but as a child, it's instilled into you that your actions have repercussions. So as you grow older and older, I suppose that. But these bankers just—they turn that on its head. It's like they've gone back to like almost below a child, where they're any kind of the responsibility has been removed from them. They're in essence kind of like. It's like power without responsibility. I guess that they just. So I suppose that the society hadn't punished them at all, really.
No, I mean, it certainly seems they're above the law. I mean, is there any patterns that emerge through that list of 80?
The only pattern is that they weren't investigated. I mean, I suppose, read all of them in the face of overwhelmingly suspicious evidence. Just. For example, the guy who shot himself with a nail gun, and I think it was in a bath. He actually shot himself with a nail gun in a bath, which seems like as a policeman, you might, in terms of an investigation, I think they put it as an unexplained death. But some of the on situ, which were from the bulletins that came from the papers. I'd guess within a fairly short time frame, given the information about the case, they weren't like, it was always unexplained death, unexplained death, unexplained death. They never, it wasn't, it could have been much more, if they were honest, if I went there and said someone, this guy's come into the bathroom and shot himself with a nail gun, I'd say that was kind of, and you know, some of them are a lot of them are, I'd say, just much more suspicious.
I mean, you know, you would expect that was murder, unless there was some very strong evidence that it was suicide. You certainly wouldn't presume it was suicide, but that's what's happened with many of these. And are there any main countries, you know, which part of the world is this mainly going on, these unexplained banker deaths?
Well, it would be the UK and America primarily.
Well, that's the belly of the beast.
And a lot of them, yeah. I mean, what you're looking at is, it is, I suppose, Europe as well. A lot of them are UBS bankers. There's three top banks that really that top the list. I did a little list, and can you guess what three?
Oh dear, that's a bit awkward. But I'm going to guess Goldman Sachs. I'll guess JP Morgan. I'll guess UBS. You've just given me a bit of a steer on that. But anyway, how did I get on?
You did one out of three, so yeah. You're 30% there, 33%.
So only the one that you told me, UBS?
No, it was JP Morgan.
Okay. So UBS isn't high up there. So anyway, so which are the other top three with JP Morgan?
Well, JP Morgan is number one. And that basically means that I think it was maybe 40% of 70 deaths with JP Morgan. That's a fairly as a breakdown, that they're pretty expendable. Deutsche Bank, obviously run the currency markets in Europe.
Well, also they've taken over, really. I mean, I spoke to a director last year of the Bundesbank, a former director, and he was looking at me with his sort of faraway eyes saying, well, I'm afraid the Bundesbank is being surpassed by Deutsche Bank, and I'm very worried about it because this is a private bank running the German markets and the euro markets for their own private gain. And, you know, he was looking kind of guilty as a German, saying we've let this one slip away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Deutsche Bank is, I think, you know, they've managed to, they're not any different to any other. If you say JP Morgan and you say Deutsche Bank, I think Deutsche Bank don't have quite as much. They got done for doing the LIBOR rate, didn't they, a few years ago with Barclays and Deutsche. So they're not that clean. But I guess that people almost see them as like Germany's national bank now, because they're so ingrained in the, you know, they actually think it's, because it's Deutsche Bank, maybe they believe it's like the state bank. But
okay, and who's the third one?
I think it was we got JP Morgan, we got Deutsche. Goldman only had two executives on the list. They were dodgy, but they were not certainly not the dodgiest. Let me have a look. I think it was UBS was number three. It might have been UBS.
Oh, I didn't do so bad then, did I? Two out of three.
Yeah, okay. We'll give you that.
Anyway, look, Michael, the reason we were chatting to you today, I mean, I'd love to know how many interviews, you know, the press has phoned up and done with you, because you've done some absolutely amazing research here. No one else has bothered to do.
Mm-hmm. I like to think so, yeah. I like to keep it rolling on, you know.
So have you had a requests from Newsnight and other places around the world to go and tell everybody about this? I mean, you think in any sane world that there would be some massive scandal and an enormous great public inquiry into the death of, I mean, we're looking at JP Morgan, that's roughly 30 people, you know, 40% of your list. And 70 or so bankers at JP Morgan. We're looking at a vast number of people dying in mysterious circumstances in one bank. You would have thought that this would be all over the newspapers, and that there would be an enormous great public inquiry, arrests and all sorts going on. But there, you know, I'd like to know, how many interviews have you done on the topic?
Well, I've never done, apart from the one I did on your for you last year, I think it was. No one's been particularly interested in it.
Oh, God. And this just makes me so annoyed that you've got such an interesting, you know, key subject. I mean, money is what makes the world go round. It's the one topic that everybody needs to understand now as we start to hit austerity, potentially another crash. A lot of people warning that there might be a proper crash this time, not a bailout of the banks, but a total collapse of the system. And yet nobody seems to be interested that the people who are supposed to be running that system are being bumped off at a rate of knots. But anyway, look, the problem is being, really, getting your michaeltyler.co.uk website out there and getting people to look at it, to take it seriously, to ask questions, at the very least, about these banker deaths. But I know that since Google brought in their new algorithm, I think it was announced in April, and it was introduced probably July, August time sometime. You've seen a bit of a dip in the number of people finding your website.
Well, Tony, I used to live in China, and when I was in China, I wrote some how-to articles about just for expats and the best way to use the Chinese, you know, to adapt to life in China. These did really well. I mean, I put them on some of the expat sites, and they did really, really well. You know, they used to get like 40 to 70 hits a day, I guess. And people used to come along and read those. And the dead bankers thing was quite, you know, that was still going on. And a few other pieces, which are obviously of interest about, just about current affairs and stuff, like the Chinese building the islands and all the rest of the political kind of stuff, east-west kind of stuff, and the machinations and whatever. So it was quite popular. It used to do quite well. It was in April this year, and I noticed that my stats dropped off quite heavily. And I suppose by heavily, I mean probably about 30 to 40 to... No, I think it was even more than that. I think it would probably be about 60%. I think they probably dropped off by about 60%. Not on all the same articles at the same time, but just during the course of that month, I think they just peeled off. And I think I'd say 60% would probably be a fair amount of, you know, what I actually lost.
I mean, Google was actually selling itself, and this is how it came. It first came into the market in the 1990s. It was, the idea was that they had the best spidering service. So they went out, and every new website, as soon as it did, Google discovered a new website, it would go in, it would grab all the pages. It also was very, very good at finding you what you wanted on your search, based on your search. And now it seems from April on, their emphasis is no longer on that. It's on, is this mainstream press? And the thing is, the thing that bothers me is that, hang on, the internet was, the great thing about the internet was you would get on a Google search what you were looking for. You wouldn't get what the mainstream press wanted to tell you. It now seems as if Google has gone away from that whole idea. They've actually, I suppose, reneged on what was their reason to be there, apparently, in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, they actually, when they bought the Dejan News archives, I don't know if you've got any old Newsnet listeners on here, but it was obviously ARPANET, and it was to, I suppose, to give them credibility with the techies. They bought up ARPANET and all the old Newsnet archives of many, many years back.
Hang on, is this News Groups you're talking about? I can remember those from years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously they had all the... you had all the lots of everybody. Well, I mean, it was obviously a big thing. So you had lots of, they bought the Dejan News archives, and that was thousands and thousands of postings from, I suppose, the pre-internet celebrities like, Serdar Argic, and, I suppose you've got Speed Bump and Borsi and all the rest of the old, hip crime, all these sort of characters who underwrote the internet, you know, who were the forerunners of the internet, really. So when they bought that up, people thought, yeah, oh, look, you know, and it was kind of a good, you know, so everyone got the warm fuzzies for them. And you used to be able to search on Usenet, so it got a lot of that old crowd into the Google, and they thought, well, that's a great big, you know, it was a nice kind of halo, and it was a warm glow for them. You know, if you still believe that, then I think you need to just read how deeply the American government controls what Google, number one, passes to the federal state in America, and number two, how much influence they have on what Google does potentially.
I mean, so someone that knows a reasonable amount about, you know, you're a bit of a techie yourself. What's going on with this new algorithm that Google have then? I mean, how important is that as a change?
Well, it's not what they've done is because it's the money from the YouTube thing that went once the, I think it's ISIS how-to videos were getting click-throughs from corporate websites. So video of like a beheading would be appearing next to SmithKline Beecham's toothpaste kind of thing. So a lot of the advertisers were like, you know, we're hand in hand with radical Islam kind of thing, which was the preface or the mandate to go ahead and kind of just pull the rug out from anyone that they saw fit kind of thing.
This is this whole scandal of demonetization. So people who are getting, you know, even millions of hits on their videos will get actually no payment for it because Google refuses to run ads on them.
That's the deal, yeah. And it's censorship. They're basically, I mean, I've got like a couple of people, Dave Rubin, he was a presenter and he was someone that had, you know, he'd made his own career before he moved on to the new media. And he basically went on as a new way, like Trump tweets, he kind of got on there and it was something that really worked for him. And he'd based, you know, this is the extent of his income, I'd guess. So he found himself demonetized and he's you can look him up, his name's Dave Rubin. He did a feature on Sky. Tucker Carlson did an interview on Sky with him. And he's basically just had his life removed. Another person called Jacqueline Glenn, very, very popular YouTube, just as a magazine. Again, her whole life just removed. I ran a website and it got bought by the BBC and they just completely removed it. And these people, there's another story about Forbes, again, just completely remove it. You know, if they don't like you, it's not the first time they've done it. Google have been doing this for a long, long time.
So I mean, Google, a lot of people don't realise YouTube is Google. So then when they bought YouTube up, look, at the end of the day, Google have got this little strap line, haven't they? Don't be evil. I think that's supposed to be part of their reason of being there. And isn't it supposed to be something that the employees all say and think to themselves every day?
that's an interesting concept, isn't it? And it gives them the fuzzy glow, doesn't it? But that fuzzy glow, everybody would like to believe that someone is good. You know, there's some good in the world.
Well, we all like to give people the benefit of the doubt, don't we?
I think we'd like to. I don't, Tony, because I think that that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, I would like to think that initially, I'd say people like Google, sure, they'd like to believe that they dropped that years ago anyway. Just the shareholders, I mean, you know, the whole, like, if you think about the stock market and any privatized company, and then you think about the reality of who your customer is. If you're a privatized company, think about who the reality of who's your real customer. And then you go back to the market and say, don't be evil. It's not going to wash, is it? It's michaeltyler.co.uk. And it has been censored. They've knocked it down quite a lot. The censorship thing, again, they're just overstepping. They're using it as a kind of, you know, as a mandate to go out. My site did how-to articles and they've just removed it. And these other people like Dave Rubin just remove them. You know, they're using it to censor innocent people.
And actually, you're one of the only people who's looking into one of the biggest stories in the world. So anyway, Michael, amazing and horrifying, really, to think that somebody like you should be, for your work, should be being demoted down to the third or whatever page in Google so people can't find you. Pretty damn sinister stuff. Anyway, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect again.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Or subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. www.thisweekcritic.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Dave Coates, also Jane Hoskins and Adrian Galvin, and also to Mary Pike. And finally, Michael Tyler, you just heard there. Also, of course, studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. They're online at prsc.org.uk. And you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. I'm gonna go to the bathroom.
Sorry about the the reverential delay there. I was I've dropped a pound coin on the floor and was underneath the desk trying to reclaim it when the record ended. My goodness me, chest pains, all that exercise, good lord. Anyway, what did I just play you? That was Mammal and Tanuga, and that's on Pyramid Records from the compilation of the Chakra compilation, Return to the Source.